this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, they're the views of our special guest for this next hour, Mr. Kevin Annette. And we're going to be talking about something which I still have to admit I hadn't heard of before I ran into Kevin. And then, of course, as I picked up the paper this last week or so, we find that several references to the fact that the Prime Minister of Canada went before some board or the Parliament and actually apologized for the mistreatment of Indian children some years ago. Well, Kevin's been trying to bring this out for many, many years. In fact, he actually was a minister, ordained minister, and he came under tremendous pressure from his own church and was eventually defrocked for daring to suggest that what was true really was true. So I'm going to let him really tell you this story because he knows it far better than I have. He's dedicated his life to getting the true story out. And of course, as always, even though many of the children died, there'll be no punishment at all for the perpetrators of a truly genocidal atrocity. Kevin, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why don't you pick up this story?
I'm sorry, why?
Why don't you just go ahead?
Why don't I? Okay. Well, it's in the news a lot now because of this supposed apology, but this is something that's not going to be dealt with just by a few words. You're quite right when you say the perpetrators aren't going to be brought to trial. In many ways, I think the apology was a way to avoid having people held accountable for what actually happened. So when you just read a list of the things that went on there, this is the kind of thing that really an apology doesn't even begin to heal.
Why don't you explain to our listeners what this was really all about, when this happened, and of course, what happened to the children?
Well, it spanned over a century. It started, I mean, you could say it started when the first Europeans arrived on native land, but in terms of Canada and this whole thing, the residential schools started during the 1800s, but they were really set up with government support around the 1890s. And for about a century after that, all the mainline churches, so that's the Catholic, Anglican, United Church, the Methodist, the Presbyterians, they all ran these Indian boarding schools where children had to go or their parents would go to jail. And the government's own figures show that about half the children never came back from these places.
And, of course, the whole idea, they wanted to take the Indian out of the Indian. They wanted to breed the children into the white man's world. And, of course, they were going to force these children, take them away from their families, from their heritage, and of course, force them to go along with the white man's approach to life. And so what happened to these children? This went on for a century, and it was promoted by the churches with, of course, financing of the government. Don't the people in the churches feel any feeling of responsibility for what happened to those children?
Well, I don't believe they do. Like, for the only reason the apology started was because the lawsuits began in 1996. Before that, you never heard the churches refer to these schools at all, except in a positive light. And still to this day, they haven't been held accountable. Most of the money given to the survivors in compensation has come from Canadian taxpayers, not from the churches. And no one has ever gone to jail in Canada for the death of a child in a residential school.
Why don't you tell us, how did you find out about this? How did you get involved?
Well, it really began for me when I arrived in Port Alberni in 1992 as a minister in the United Church there, and I began to meet people who survived the residential school. I saw how their life continued to be shattered by what happened. If you take all the Native people in Canada and rank them as a nation, their standard of living is 64th in the world.
I mean, hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead, Kevin.
I was saying that if you took all the Native people and ranked them as a nation, their standard of living would be about number 64 in the world, somewhere around Thailand or Brazil. And so they're really, most Native people are in a this island of poverty, and they're never getting out of it. I mean, the reality is that it's a permanent kind of situation for people. So to pretend that these things happened long ago and we've apologized and making things better, that's really kind of a myth that a lot of white people propagate, especially the government and the churches.
All right, so you actually talked to the people and you found out what had happened to them, and so what did you do? I suppose you're pretty young at this time, and well, what year was that?
Well, I was 36 when I got to Port Alberni. I'm 52 now.
All right.
I just did what I thought a minister should do and go out and open up my church to the community. I invited Native people in. We had a food bank, and I invited people to speak from the pulpit about their life and about their thoughts. And we gradually began to hear more and more stories of these kinds of atrocities. I wrote to the church leaders about it, and I pretty much was told to shut up and not say anything about it. But the thing that quenched my firing was I found out that the church had been engaging in land speculation with stolen Native land. And there were, you know, deals going on between themselves and various logging companies, including Weyerhaeuser, a big American, actually it's the biggest logging company in the world, is based in Seattle. And, you know, there's all these kind of backroom deals going on, and I wrote to the church about it, and they summarily fired me.
In other words, the church and the people in the church were profiting from this?
Yeah, they had this land, their missionaries had basically stolen at Cannon Point from the Native people. And then over the years, they just sold it off to various, you know, corporate benefactors of the church, and none of the money ever went back to the Native people. So, you know, I just called the church on that on a humanitarian ground, and I was fired for it. But what really expelled me from the church was the fact that I kept asking questions about what happened in the residential schools. And that was before the lawsuits. It was before it was fashionable to talk about residential schools. And I was driven out of the church. I was defrocked. The only minister in United Church history ever to be publicly defrocked. Cost the church about $250,000. And they even intervened and helped break up my marriage, helped my wife and her divorce against me. So, you know, they were acting in a pretty desperate manner because they knew what was coming out is their whole kind of dark history.
And, of course, has this ever gotten it to the public? I mean, the public began to realize not only what the government did, but what the church had done?
Well, I tried over the years. You know, at first I was really isolated. I didn't have any support. I started by producing a book called...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Kevin is really a very courageous young man. He was 36 years old when he first found out about this. What's going on? He's 52 now. It's resulted in his being defrocked, the only minister ever defrocked. Why? Because he talked about the fact that the churches up there were actually stolen land from the Native Indians and then sold it off, and the missionaries had been involved in this, and they couldn't let the public know about this. Not only that, they couldn't let the public know how many of these children had died. Do we have any idea how many children did die in these residential schools that were run by the church and under government auspices?
Yeah, well, we know that the average death rate for many decades was 50% or so. Just a simple calculation shows it's in the tens of thousands of children, possibly as much as 50 or 60,000 kids who never came back over a century. And I began to document this in the book I published, Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. I should actually mention to listeners that you can see all of this stuff, including our documentary film called Unrepentant, and that's on our website at www.hiddenfromhistory.org. But a lot of the evidence is up there, and over the years I've just made this public, and finally the government, you know, I guess this issue reached a critical mass. A lot of people were learning more about it, and the government realized they had to respond.
And, of course, anybody can go up on the Internet, just Google in Prime Minister of Canada apologizes for the residential schools, that's the term that's used. And certainly there was an article just this last week or so in the New York Times that had talked about the rape and sexual abuse of these children, and then mentioned, yes, and the deaths. Ladies and gentlemen, it's difficult for the average individual to believe this sort of thing could really go on in civilized society. I remember when I was a young orthopedic surgeon, training to be an orthopedist. This would have been 1957, 1958, somewhere there. We went up to the Santa Rosa, the school there for mentally defective children. It was really a hospital for mentally defective children. And the orthopedist there in charge said that when he had gone there a few years previously, it was a standard policy if a mentally defective child got pneumonia, they simply moved their bed over by the window and opened it up so pneumonia would get worse, so it would die. And, of course, he objected to that. He thought it was wrong to kill mentally objective, defective children. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about 1950s right here in the United States. But, of course, the same sort of thing went on. They used plutonium-laced cereal. They gave it to literally tens of thousands and thousands of our children, mentally defective children and orphans, and killed them here. And this is in the immediate post-World War II era. We never talk about these things because, after all, we're civilized, aren't we? We wouldn't allow that sort of thing the Nazis would have done. Well, Kevin's been on the front lines of this battle for many years. When did they close down the residential schools?
Well, the last one was closed in 1996. A lot of them were closed in the 1970s and 80s. But the thing to remember is that they carried on in various ways. Like, Native children are still being taken from the homes and deculturalized, if you like, raised in white homes where they don't learn their language. That's increasing constantly, that process of splitting up Native families. So the effect is ongoing, even if the residential schools still aren't around anymore. And so the impact are intergenerational, you know. It's not just something in the past.
So you think maybe as many as 50,000 of the children died in these residential schools. What did they die from? Was it neglect? Was it a diet? Was it a physical abuse, sexual abuse?
Well, all of the above, really. I mean, a lot of the deaths happened en masse because of a practice of deliberately exposing kids to disease and then never treating them. That was described even by a government doctor called Peter Bryce, who did a tour of the hospitals in 1907 and found that wherever he went, the same practice was going on. The children were being housed together. Kids who were dying of tuberculosis with healthy kids, and then none of them ever treated. So they were staying by and contaminating these kids and then just letting them die off. I think, you know, in the early years, that was definitely to depopulate whole areas of the native people so that the white settlers could get the land, the logging companies could get the trees and that kind of thing. That's just part of what happened all across this continent, you know.
But, of course, here's a specific instance in Canada. I'm not saying the same sort of things haven't happened here in this country, where, of course, I believe the Indians in many cases have been certainly badly mistreated. But, of course, it's always under the name of, well, if we could just make them more like us, why, they'd be fine. But it really wasn't about simply trying to change their attitude. It was about really taking their property, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, very much about getting the land. In a lot of the documents I found, government Indian agents and missionaries are very clear about that, you know, we have to locate these residential schools near to the wealthy fishing grounds, you know, and the prime, resources and that kind of thing. So it was part of a bigger plan, which is easy to forget about now that we've got the land, but it was clearly a big part of, you know, big motivation in this.
Well, of course, how were the missionaries involved? I mean, we like to think of missionaries being there to spread the word of God and to bring people into a personal relationship with our Lord. Oh, how were the missionaries involved, and were they simply being paid off by government?
Well, you know, in Canada, it was very much that missionaries were an agent of the British Empire. And, they went into an area to what they call Christianize and Canadianize people, that is, make them into loyal subjects of the crown and good citizens at the same time. That was totally intermingled when you look at the writings of these missionaries. They were there for that dual purpose. So they didn't really separate their own personal faith from their role as, you know, kind of an agent of the empire. And they really believed that, you know, when you became like a British subject, you became closer to God. Definitely that attitude. The Catholic Church actually ran about three-quarters of the schools, but they were operating under the control of the British Crown, too. So, you had the same kind of agenda at work.
Well, of course, as you try to get this information out, and of course this made you extremely unpopular, did you have any help, or was it simply that most of the Indians were afraid to speak out for fear of retribution?
I've had very little help over the years. I mean, people have come and gone, but Native people are terrified. I mean, they were raised... Those that survived this system are completely traumatized, by and large, even the ones who never went into the school. They go around in a state of fear and also kind of a need for approval and acceptance into the white world. You know, you saw an example of that when this apology came out. Very few Native leaders came out and condemned the apology. They didn't, for years, they haven't asked questions about what happened to their relatives, why none of these kids ever came home from the schools. And that makes a real difficulty in terms of getting this whole story out, because there isn't a lot of people in the Native world willing to really put things on the line over this issue that I found.
Well, you'd say 50,000 died, but certainly through all these years, it would have been a lot more than 100,000 Indian children would have gone to the schools. What happened to the rest of them? Do we have any idea?
Well, you know, if you think about close to half of them never came back. Those that did survive, a lot of them have died since then. They've taken their own lives. They've died from diabetes and alcoholism and violence. So even though they weren't part of the original group killed, the vast majority died off as a result of these, and they still are dying off because of the effects of the schools. So, you know, you could eventually say that most people who went through this system died at his hands.
All right. Well, certainly, basically, you know, you have a website, you have a DVD, you have a book written on this, and certainly there must have been something that precipitated the Prime Minister of Canada at this time in history coming forward, because up until now I'd never heard of it. And as you commented, I think it was our last time we talked, he told me the Prime Minister had apologized, and I pick up my New York Times and one of the other newspapers I read, and there's the story, just exactly as you said it. It was almost unbelievable. How could they have concealed this for 100 years, this mistreatment of the Indian children? This is the thing. Where, you know, was the American media? Where was the Canadian media? And really, was it the lawsuits that really caused them to come forward now and say, yes, oh yes, too bad about that, but nobody will ever be held responsible. We'll just go ahead and give them money. It's sort of like the Catholic Church. Oh yes, a lot of these children were abused and sexually abused and pedophilia and homosexuality, but, you know, we'll just pay you off and that's the end of it.
No, it wasn't the lawsuits that caused this change. The lawsuits had pretty much contained the issue, that silenced people with gag orders and lump money settlements. What I believe really caused this were a couple of things. First of all, the release of our documentary film last year, which really was exposed all over the Internet. There's been over 40,000 hits on it, and it's been, you know, received all over the world, really. There's a growing awareness of the deaths that happened in the schools because of that film. And it was interesting that soon after its release, this issue was raised in the Parliament of Canada for the first time in April 2007. And then the major media began reporting it, this the issue of the deaths of children. But another thing that really prompted the government doing this, they knew that the 2010 Olympics is happening in British Columbia. And that is kind of going to be a big centerpiece of Canada's reputation, you know. And if that's in any way impeded, Canada's really going to suffer for it. You know, it's very dependent on trade and tourism, this country. And if its image falters as a humanitarian nation, a lot of people are going to suffer in the white world for it. So they knew they had to do a containment operation. They knew that, okay, we have to be able to say to the world, we are investigating this, we're apologizing, we're getting to the bottom of it. And that's what this whole publicity stunt of the apology is all about.
Well, in the article I read, they were talking about putting up $1 billion or $2 billion or for payouts to the survivors of that. Now, is that something new, or is that something, because apparently it wasn't just going to be in response to lawsuits, but everybody was going to get a certain amount of money.
No, but they don't. The reality is, and I work with a lot of these people on the ground, the vast majority of survivors will never see any of that money, because they're doing things to continually disqualify people from receiving the money. The government has self-admitted, they claim there's only 80,000 survivors left, but I think that's a small number. They claim that 35,000 of those 80,000 have already been disqualified for receiving a penny of compensation. So nearly half of the people are cut off from receiving any money. Where that money goes is into the hands of government-funded Native chiefs and white social workers and lawyers. Those are the people gathered, you know, profiting off that money.
It's so like Brofman, a fellow, brought a suit against the Swiss banks for holding back the money from the Holocaust victims. He got a $6.5 billion settlement, and he's never given any of it to the Holocaust victims. So I guess that's sort of the same system works, you know. Was there a tribal chief or a man named Brofman of Seagram's whiskey? Doesn't really matter. It's because he's got the money rules. That's sort of the way it works. Well, this is Dr. Sten. Our guest is Kevin Nutt. And certainly, you know, I think you played a very, very important role in getting this out, and we certainly want to get your DVD. In fact, we'll try to link our website with your website so that can actually go there and see that DVD. How long is the story?
The movie is about just over an hour and a half, and people can view it either on our website, hiddenfromhistory.org, or on Google Video. It's called Unrepentant,
Unrepentant
in Canada's Genocide.
Unrepentant, and that's on Google Video, huh?
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, because that'll be probably the easiest way for us down here to link into that site. What else do you have on your website that would be of interest to people?
Well, we have oral testimonies from survivors, people who survived sterilization programs.
So they didn't have a sterilization program, too, and so Indians wouldn't have any children, so you wouldn't have to worry about the next generation.
That's right. So we had those kinds of stories up. We have updates, a lecture series I gave on kind of the roots of genocide in the West and that kind of thing. So there's quite a lot for people to see there.
All right, fine. Well, tell us a little bit about the sterilization program. Was this being forced on everybody? Was it being offered? Or how did they carry out their sterilization program?
Well, there were laws brought in Western Canada during the 1920s and 30s which allowed any Native person to be sterilized. And there have been lawsuits about this. Probably thousands of Native people went under the knife or were exposed to X-rays, various ways of killing off, any hope of a future for these people. This whole thing is really part of a bigger issue of eugenics. And there's actually a good book people can get called War Against the Weak, America's Plan to Create a Master Race, by Edwin Black. And it shows how in the United States in the 1880s, this whole eugenics movement began, which said, yeah, we've got to sterilize not only the mentally defective, we've got to sterilize Native people and blacks and anybody who's different, anybody who we think is not, quote, racially pure or whatever. I mean, it was aimed at anybody who was considered a dissident or different. And this was a very widespread movement. So it wasn't just aimed at Native people. There was a lot of people who were targeted for sterilization. And frankly, Adolf Hitler just picked up what had already started over here, and he applied it in a bigger way in Nazi Germany.
They just used German efficiency for the programs that actually came from America. Yes, you're absolutely right. The eugenic program began in America, largely financed by the Rockefeller Foundation for Margaret Sanger, and that's why she set up her abortion clinics predominantly in black neighborhoods. And she openly talked in her book, The Pivot of Civilization, about how they wanted to breed a perfect race, like a racehorse. You breed racehorses, you breed human beings, and they were going to get rid of a lot of the blacks. And they've done a pretty good job of that here in the United States. And, of course, it's so difficult for people in America to believe this could have happened to our blacks. But what we're talking about is, of course, what the Canadians did to their Indians. And, of course, forced stabilization, sterilization. Now, have the lawsuits on that largely been settled? Whatever happened to the lawsuits on the forced sterilization?
Well, there was only one class action suit in Alberta in 1999, and it won a bit of money for something like 2,800 Native women who had been sterilized. But again, it was the same story. You give people a bit of money, they can't talk about their story anymore, and they consider that justice. The people who did it, just like the government and churches, they're never held accountable. They never have to do any time for these crimes. So because of that, it can happen again tomorrow.
Amen to that. Hold on. We'll be back here in just a moment with Kevin Nutt. Well, this is Dr. Sten, and certainly most Americans really do not believe the sort of things could go on in America and in Canada that have actually gone on. People have heard of the Tuskegee story. We have a great four-tape set on the Tuskegee study, if you've never heard of it. And that is, of course, where the U.S. Public Health Service plotted to kill 400 black men by withholding treatment for their syphilis so they could autopsy them and see how they died. And nobody was ever held responsible. Small financial settlement after the story was blown back about 1972. But, of course, none of the people responsible for the plan and for the deaths of all these black people were ever held responsible. And, of course, we know the same thing happened to many of the children, many of the orphans in America, or children with mentally defective problems, were experimented on with radiation or with plutonium. But we don't like to talk about that sort of thing. It makes us feel uneasy. Well, we ought to feel uneasy because those same people may be very well plotting to continue doing exactly the same thing in the future. And if men are not held responsible for their crimes, whether it be in the United States or Canada, those crimes will continue. Well, Kevin was just saying when we were off the air that there had been a class action suit brought in Alberta by women. How many women had been sterilized there that involved in the class action suit?
Well, there was about 2,800 in the class action suit, but a lot more people than that were sterilized.
And at first, basically, they were told that once you get your money and you're going to be a few thousand dollars, but you can never talk about this publicly.
Yep.
And so they always seal this and they put a gag order on her because the last thing they want is for the average Canadian, who's really a decent individual. I love the Canadian people. In fact, I married one of them. But basically, they're good people. They're wholesome people. But they can't believe this could happen in their country. And if it does, they don't want to think about it. That is the big problem. Somehow, if we don't think about it, it really didn't occur.
Yeah, very much.
Well, now, as far as if you're concerned, certainly we saw the forced sterilization, and you've told us how they basically actually contaminated these children, put them into wards with children who had fulminant tuberculosis, and nobody was getting treated, and then the uninfected become infected, and this obviously had to be done intentionally, certainly if you have somebody who's got an infectious disease, you isolate them, you don't put other healthy people in with them. That is, unless you want them to contract the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And now, Sydney, you say the residential schools stayed open until the late, about the mid-1900s? Mid-1990s?
1990s, yeah. That's when they closed.
Well, what are they doing at the present time? You said that a lot of these programs are still continuing, even though the residential schools have closed down.
Well, the effects continue in the Native community. You know, when families destroyed by the effects of these schools, it doesn't mend very easily. Native people die at a rate between 15 and 20 times higher than the national average. I know a lot of Native people who die in their 40s from diabetes, who die blindly, die from the effects of drug and alcohol. And the point is this is increasing all the time. It's not decreasing. There's no indication that things are improving for most Native people on the ground. So, you know, you can trace a lot of this to this whole impact of when you're targeted for extermination. There's an Indian Act in Canada which controls Native people. There's no other ethnic group in the country targeted by a specific act like that, which basically makes them wards of the state where they don't have the same rights as other people. So the question is, why is that Indian Act continuing if Canada is what it claims to be, which is a humanitarian multicultural nation? Why is there a separate category of citizenship for Native people?
Well, it seems that there's sort of an attitude that the Indian can't look after himself, so he's going to put him onto a reservation and give him welfare so that the paternalistic government will look after it because they're there to look after their good health.
Well, that's the rationale, but don't forget that that's a convenient rationale. If you want to take somebody's land and legally wipe them out, you have to reduce them to the status of a dependent. Say, well, they couldn't live without us, therefore they need these laws. They need to be put on special reserves. They need to be told what to think and how to live. And once you've reduced people to that state, you can do anything you want to them. You can even kill them in secret, and nobody will really bat an eye.
And, of course, you say that many of the tribal chiefs have simply been bought off by the government?
Very much. I mean, the whole system, there's about $6 billion a year goes into Indian affairs. Most of that money is never seen by the 75% of Native people who live off reserve, you know, who don't have access to that money at all. A few families control that.
And, of course, do the Indians still control a fair amount of land up there, or most of that land has been stolen?
No. Most Native people are completely landless. They live in the cities. They don't have their own land anymore. That land is grabbed increasingly by big corporations, by the government.
Under one guise or another.
Yep.
Well, certainly, our guest this evening is Kevin Annett, and this really is a very, very tragic story. The tragic story of what happened to the Indians in Canada, the residential schools where they set out to de-Indian the Indians, and of course they did in a lot of the Indians. When we get back, we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. If any of the people in within Parliament are taking this on as an effort to do something, or is everybody trying to still sweep it under the rug and, well, we've apologized, now that should do the trick?
Yeah, that's the attitude. I mean, I've approached politicians for years, and until this year, nobody was willing to talk about this issue at all. And now they're talking about it in a very controlled way, or contained way, where, yeah, they'll acknowledge that children died, but they won't say how they died or who killed them and who's responsible. That's all left completely off the board.
Well, now, you talk a lot about sexual abuse as well, and certainly you would think that this would be considered a serious crime here in America. Why, of course, pedophilia is a terrible, terrible thing, which it really is, and certainly, but of course, we're talking about sexual abuse of literally tens of thousands of children up there, almost as if it was condoned by the state.
We're not talking about random perpetrators. We're talking about a whole system in place that deliberately did this systematically to children, every child who went in there, to terrorize them, to traumatize them, and allow them to be better controlled. And, you know, that's not something that's comparable to any other crime that occurs in society. There's a whole regime in work to make that happen to every child. So that's different than, you know, the trial of a lone perpetrator or pedophile.
All right, fine. And so this, when it becomes government policy to actually allow sexual abuse in an effort to terrorize children, and what was this, to keep them from speaking out?
To get the land to destroy the native community right at its foundation, which is the family. Create a long-term time bomb, if you like, whereby native people will end up destroying themselves because of the effects of it. That way the white society can stand back and not look guilty. They don't have to all be lined up against a wall like what happened in Serbia or Rwanda or Nazi Germany. You know, the long-term effect is that people wipe themselves out and are killed off, and that's called genocide.
Well, because, you know, apparently alcoholism is a terrible, terrible problem among the Indians up there.
Well, more and more it's drugs. I mean, a lot of the problems you see on the streets are drug-related, not so much alcohol, although that's a really bad problem, too, especially in the older generations.
All right, fine. So you say, what is it, cocaine, morphine, things of that sort?
Cocaine is a big one on the street. It's affordable, and a lot of the native people survive on the streets here by dealing it.
And these are, of course, people who really are, of course, more or less destitute, living on the streets, because they have... aren't there reservations there that they can go to where they at least would have land on the reservation?
Well, they're kind of blackmailed. If you live on the reservation, you're under the Indian Act, and you have no control over your own life. Your band council can be removed by the Minister of Indian Affairs. You can't even make a renovation to your home without written permission from Ottawa.
Hold that thought. I'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Kevin is simply saying, if you're an Indian and you live in Canada and you live on a reservation, why, of course, you're totally under the control of the government. You can't even make a modification to your home without permission of the Indian minister in Ottawa, Canada. You're living out in British Columbia, but you can't do anything. You're totally controlled. So many of the Indians have left the reservation. They've gone to the cities, but they have no property. They have no means of making a living, and they've really become the derelicts of society. And of course, Kevin's intention is, and I rather suspect he's absolutely right, that this is part of the plan. And they die at a very, very young age that way. And then one day you're not going to have to worry about the embarrassment of having Indians there have been mistreated, because there'll be less and less, and ultimately no Indians left. Do you think that's pretty what the plan is?
I think definitely that's part of a long-term plan of ethnic cleansing here in Canada, yes.
And, of course, let's go ahead and get your website out. And then if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But what about your website, Sydney?
It's www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and people should read it and listen to the voices on there and look at the movie Unrepentant. That tells a lot if you just can, you know, look at those things.
And, of course, you could probably get that movie either on the website Unrepentant, or I'll go to Google and simply Google in, Unrepentant and video, and you should be able to find it. And I think it's so important people understand what happened in Canada. We could spend, and we should spend several programs talking about the programs here, the Tuskegee program, the plutonium program, the fact that they sent 4,000 Yemeni children from Israel over here, kidnapped from their families, to be used in experiments, radiation experiments, right here in the United States in the aftermath of the Second World War. And I know there's other children, about 100,000 Moroccan children, had their heads saved, and then they radiated them with phenomenal amounts of radiation in the name of treating a ringworm, but it was really all about destroying their minds. And, of course, 100,000 Moroccan children living in Israel. Of course, we finance it. Your tax money at work. Well, let's go to Ray calling from Santa Cruz. My telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And incidentally, if you'd like to check the story I just talked about, go up on the Internet, Google in Yemeni children radiation experiments. And then, of course, the Moroccan children, they call them the ringworm children. So if you want the documentation, you can't find it, we'll get it for you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. This is very, very real. We live in a fallen world. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Oh, very good. I do have a question.
Go right ahead.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs in this country, in the United States, is their agenda the same as the one in Canada? Because I know their crimes are well documented. They go back to the days of the railroads, and before that, of course, with the Cherokees. What I'm trying to say is it an overall plan throughout Northern America?
What are your thoughts on that, Kevin?
I would say yes. In the States, it's a bit different. The churches didn't have the kind of power they have up here, so BIA tended to run a lot of the boarding schools, whereas they tend to be church-run up here. But generally, besides that difference, I don't think there is much of a variation in the long-term plan.
Ray, it's one of the really amazing things. We used to keep some files in this. I'm sure we still have them. The Indians, of course, had a lot of land in Oklahoma, and there was tremendous oil profits on that. And it was all taken by the Department of Indian Affairs, supposedly to give to the Indians, and it never was given to the Indians. And some judge got involved and said, you've got to give this money to the Indians. The Department of Indian Affairs couldn't find these billions and billions and billions of dollars that they had stolen from the Indians, right? Nothing has ever done. No government official has ever held responsible.
No one
in government has ever held responsible for killing people.
When you look at the uranium mining in the States, too, you know, Native people tended to be forced off into sparse and barren land. Then years later, they would often find uranium on that land and then force them off again. That happened in South Dakota. The whole Wounded Knee shootout in the 70s was really kind of...
Right, I remember that, too.
I remember a land grab to get the uranium.
Yeah. Is Russell Means, is it Russell Means or is it Dennis Banks? Are they both fairly active, or what do they do nowadays?
They were with the American Indian Movement. I think they still are. I know definitely Russell Means is, yeah.
What really is bothers them, Ray, is most people don't want to think about this. Our government could not do anything. These had to be communists. That's what they were, communists, so it's all right to shoot them.
Yes. And the other thing, too, I was going to say that in Wyoming, they're interested in gas, and I think it's methane. I think Dick Cheney is very involved in this kind of thing.
Good, very well.
So I think the things that the government are doing are basically genocidal. You can almost parallel them with Nazi Germany in a way. But it's more subtle. It's more subtle because you don't see these people being, you know, it's just like you don't know.
That's right. Well, that's why I put the programs on, Ray, because I think Kevin's story is so vastly important. We're so glad we were able to get in touch with him. Anything else you want to say, Ray, before we
leave? Thanks.
Bye-bye. And again,
our
telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and you could just tell from Ray's voice as he was talking how deeply he feels about this, and I feel very deeply, and I know Kevin feels very deeply, and I hope you out there in the listening audience feel deeply, and you'll help at first Kevin, and I'm sure he can use help for his ministry. He's given up a great deal, having been defrocked as a minister. Why? because he had the audacity to tell the truth. And, of course, when you're in a hierarchy of a religious organization and you're challenging the leadership who's making a lot of money, why, of course, that's not very, very popular. So certainly the video is called Unrepentant, and you can get that at Google. You can get that at certainly at his website, Kevin Annett's website. And again, give the title of the website.
www.hiddenfromhistory.org.
Hidden from history? I'm writing down here with one hand.
Hidden from history is one word.
All right.
Hiddenfromhistory.org.
Okay, fine. Well, certainly, are any of the Canadians actually coming on? You said the people who come and help you temporarily and then they sort of fade away. Is that what really happens?
That's tended to be the pattern, yeah.
Well, is it because they get pressure put on them to shout?
Yes, definitely. People are being pressured to back off. A lot of white people are get nervous when they see how deep this thing goes, you know, how deep the rabbit hole goes. It's implicating a lot of the institutions they were raised to believe in. And a lot of Native people are scared for their life, frankly.
Well, have any of them actually been put under pressure or eliminated because they dared to speak out?
A few people over the years, definitely. One woman, Virginia Baptiste, who's actually in our film, she's the person who opens and closes the film. She died under very questionable circumstances in the hospital right after confronting a local Catholic church over the deaths of children in that area in southern B.C. So I believe people are being killed for this, yes.
And, of course, when you stop and think of the implications of this, how can you destroy the belief people have in the government? Well, we should never trust our government. Our founding fathers didn't trust government. And when government, of course, has power and, of course, not be held responsible, is any man's life or family safe? And this is really the problem. I believe the Canadians are good people. I believe the Americans as a whole are good people. But it seems that the wicked people always seem to get into key positions, whether it would be in government or certainly within the police or sometimes in the church. And we saw that here in the States, where, of course, the president of the National Association of Evangelical Christians, with 30 million members, 30 million evangelical Christians, a man named Ted Haggard, who is, of course, a homosexual, a drug user, and, of course, he was using his position to undermine Christianity. But how did that happen? Well, he had a lot of friends working within the hierarchy of Christianity, and most people just want to live their lives. They don't want to get ahead in organizations. Unfortunately, I find that the wicked people usually get into key positions, and, of course, they have their friends, and they promote their friends, and this is the tragedy of what happens when you have any structured organization, including religious organizations. What about the other ministers? Were they afraid to speak out and support you?
All of them, yes. They all backed off. There was one man for a while who helped me, but they got to him as well.
And so you sort of stand there alone, because you're married, and I'm sure it's been a long and painful struggle. But of course, you've done what you felt was right. And, you know, I'm sure that God has put you in the place where you are today, just as I think he places others in certain places. What really doesn't make much sense doing what you're doing, other than the fact it's right. And I believe God does want spokesmen out there as a cause of creating a feeling of consciousness and certainly of unrest in people. Everybody should be standing up. I believe a Christian has an obligation to stand, you know, whether it's popular or not, and no matter what the cost, somebody has to stand for rightness. So what's the next step? What's going to happen now, Kevin?
Well, it really depends on a lot of people in your country and around the world to come forward and hold Canada accountable. You know, Canada and the media here have really, and the churches have really contained this issue again. They, if you like, put everybody back to sleep by saying we're sorry. And this can only be countered by getting the truth out, especially about the burial sites of these children. We're trying to focus on that and bring home the remains of the kids for proper burial. And we need a lot of people in the States to circulate our film, have me come down and speak. I'm doing a speaking tour again in the fall of the United States. And they can contact me at hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca.
Well, I think certainly the videos are very, pardon me, the speaking tours are important. What about the DVD? Can they be purchased at your website?
They can get them directly from me at that email address. Yeah.
All right, fine. I think this is really what's so vitally important, is that certainly one picture is worth 1,000 words. And when people began to understand the implications of that, and it wasn't simply in Canada, they were doing similar things, perhaps, not residential schools, but they were doing similar things here in the United States to children, and I personally witnessed some of this, you know, in my years of training. It's difficult for people to say this could happen, and I didn't want to believe it could happen. How easy it is to say, well, that was just an aberration. Unfortunately, when you begin reading about the Malthusian movement in the United States, you realize it wasn't isolation. When you read about the eugenic movement in the United States, Adolf Hitler's ideas did not originate in Germany. They admitted originated right here in the United States and funded by our great tax-exempt foundations, specifically the Rockefeller Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Rockefeller set up the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin.
Right.
Which responsible for a lot of the doctors like Mengele and that in the death camps.
Right, and Ernst Gruden, of course, was the head of that. He was over here, of course, working with Margaret Sanger, but, of course, nobody wants to talk about that. Well, you know, I think obviously you're on top of this whole idea, and these ideas really go back to Malthus, and we want to breed a perfect race, perfect people. There are too many people in the world. We want to get rid of the useless eaters. As Malthus said, you know, we're going to have to build our cities next to stagnant ponds and discourage cleanliness. Why? Because that's going to create more in the way of disease and kill the people off, but this is the sort of thing that really will have to be done. And unfortunately, it has been done, and I fear in many respects it's being done right here in America today, and we're being, our people are, certainly compare the health of people in the United States, men 55 to 65 in the United States, with comparable groups in Great Britain, and we have the statistics on there. We have almost twice as much disease, heart disease, diabetes, other serious diseases as they have in comparable groups in Great Britain, and that did not happen just by accident. So, really, if people are not involved and concerned about what's going on in Canada, if they're not concerned about what's happening to children in America, if they're not concerned about Tuskegee, do they have any right to be concerned when it's one of their friends, maybe one of their relatives, one to say themselves, who are dying of cancer totally unnecessarily here in the United States? Well, Kevin, what's the next step? Are you just going to keep doing what you're doing until justice eventually is brought to the Indian population?
Well, very much. Like I said, we're trying to expand this beyond Canada. We're getting more and more support all the time. And we're asking people to do things like, don't come to the 2010 Olympics in British Columbia and write to the government of Canada and tell them why you're not going to come until, for example, there's a full inquiry done. People are brought to trial for what happened to these children. That's the kind of thing that we think will continue to put pressure on the government and the churches.
Of course, the trouble is when the government appoints a panel to investigate the government, you know what the ultimate conclusion is going to be. You have to have an independent group who have no ties to the government and are appointed by concerned people rather than by government officials. Everything has to be cover-up. They cannot let people know the truth. They feel that the public just is not smart enough to be able to accept it. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there and you have a question or comment for Kevin and Ned, and what he's saying is not very nice, but I have no question at all. It happened, and any of you can go up and on the internet and Google in a prime minister, Canadian prime minister, Indian children, or certainly the residential schools, and you'll find out what we're telling was right. And within the last week, since the last time we actually talked, these articles appeared in the New York Times and other major newspapers, and people look at it, glance at it, and go on to something else. But we see we can't allow this to be simply swept under the rug again, as it has been for over 100 years. Well, Kevin, certainly I admire you for having the courage to do what you've done. And have you ever sort of sat back and wondered, maybe I should have just let it go?
No, I've never doubted that this, I've always known this is the right thing to do, and I couldn't really have lived with myself if I had gone along with these people. I mean, I saw that what was happening around me. I couldn't, morally go along with this stuff. I think it's something anyone would do, anyone with a conscience would do the same thing.
Well, I'm sure anyone with a conscience, but it's so easy to sort of put that conscience on hold. You don't want to be controversial. I've seen this among the doctors in my community. People, you'd think they'd have the courage to speak out for what was right, and when push came to shove and there was any opposition from the other side, it was simply easier to be quiet. And, of course, I guess maybe that's human nature. What we need are people who are willing to stand up and be counted rather than simply hope very well if you're quiet, nobody's ever going to bother you. But I think this is an attitude on the part of many, many people. Well, as far as the Indians are concerned, is there any leadership within the Indian movement to try to get the information out?
Well, where that comes from is mostly from the survivors of these residential schools themselves. They're the ones, on the people on the ground, who've been the motive force. It's not really the chiefs or the official leaders who've led this at all. They're paid not to, and it's really coming from the people themselves.
All right, well, let's hope that we can raise a wave of indignation on the part of the people here in the United States. I know you're doing a good job getting that information out, and then, of course, the people of Canada. And, of course, when the people of Canada understand the implications of this and, of course, the fact that it's been covered up by the media for so long, why, of course, they begin to understand that the Canadian media, like the media in the United States, is totally controlled by what I believe are dark and sinister spiritual forces. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program, the first hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, Kevin, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program, so I'll let you just go ahead and whatever you'd like to share in the way of closing before we let you go.
Well, I wanted to kind of warn people that in the news you might be seeing stuff about this government established what they call a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And it's really set up by the government. It has no power to subpoena. It's not going to investigate crimes. You're not even allowed to name names when you come into these TRC hearings. They're not going to investigate wrongdoing by anybody or by any church. So it's really a bogus body. And we're trying to set up a real inquiry. So I would urge people to help us do that. And to again, look at our website, www.hiddenfromhistory.org. Order our book and film and have me down and speak in your community, because I'll be doing a speaking tour in the fall in the United States. And because we're getting actually a lot of support from down there. So.
All right, well, I hope that you'll get a lot more support, and I know that there are a lot of people down here who share your concern about what's going on. And, of course, the wonderful thing about talk radio is we can reach really millions of people, not necessarily myself, but through the other people that are doing what we're doing. And the more of our talk radio programs you get on down here, well, the more influence you can have. And at least we still have a lot, I believe, more freedom of of radio down here. I know you have a hard time getting Christian radio programs up there in Canada. At least we still have Christian radio in America, at least for the time being. So anyway, God bless you. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you, Stan. And I'll stay in touch.
All right. Please, if you need any help, anything we can do, give us a call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is a tragic, tragic story, and we do hope that many of you will want to get Kevin's book, that you'll want to get Kevin's DVD, and you can actually see this on the Internet. In fact, we're running on actually linking our Internet to that, and so that you'll be able to go up on our radio, on our website, which is RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, and we already have a large number of DVDs you can link to, and then my son has put up a new site, which is called Other DVDs, and we're putting out one or two or maybe three a week of important DVDs or YouTube videos that we want you to have access to. And so certainly go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, and I hope in the very near future why we can have a link to what Kevin has done. Hidden from history. You see, they have to hide this. These people cannot allow the public to learn the truth. And, of course, this is what Radio Liberty is all about. We're going to bring you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and an understanding of the Malthusian concepts, a wonderful book we have called The Legacy of Malthus. And Malthus was really lived a couple of hundred years ago, but he's behind everything going on today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we do hope that you enjoyed our interview with Kevin Annette. We actually have another interview with him I think was even better. And, of course, we want you to have this information. You can, of course, get tapes of our programs or CDs of our programs by calling 1-800-544-8927. Now, you can also listen to our programs, and if you want to record them yourself, they are at radioliberty.com, and, of course, they are archived. archived, and they're on MP3, and they're going to be actually set up so you can, if you have a blogger, you'll be able to pull those down and put them on your iPod, and then of course put them onto disk yourself. That's fine with us. You know, we appreciate your financial support, but the major thing is we want to get the information out, and you can help us by going to our website, pulling down the programs, and we're actually recording putting our 3 o'clock program in the afternoon on, as well as the 4 o'clock program. So there'll be 4 hours a day archived of Radio Liberty, and then of course you can get them on MP3. You can of course listen live there, but you can listen 9 hours a day to our satellite feed at RadioLiberty.com, and just click on to online, listen online. Well, ladies and gentlemen, of course, behind all of what's going on today are powerful spiritual forces. We've got a great 4-CD set called Tuskegee, and you really need, of course, to get that and to listen to it and to understand. The Tuskegee study was a plan to kill black people, and there is a conspiracy against black people in the United States. We have a book by Don Scott, AIDS, the unbelievable crime, I think it is. Anyway, it's because it's a very, very important book, and we recommend it to you. And you need to get my interviews with Don Scott. You have to understand, AIDS is specifically genetically modified to affect blacks. This is genetically created disease. How do we know that? Well, a couple of the people involved have come forward. There's a book called Full Disclosure by Gary Glum. And, of course, he got into trouble with the IRS because he published it, but he simply recorded what one of the men who worked on the project had told him about how they created this terrible, terrible new disease. And then our friend Dr. Garth Nicholson had talked to at least one person who was involved. We actually have the CIA records of, they call the Special Virus Cancer Project, that actually the CIA hired scientists from across the country to create new and terrible diseases. And, of course, the plan was to create new and deadly diseases. We have the testimony of Dr. David MacArthur. It's available from Radio Liberty. Dr. David MacArthur testified before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, asked for $10 million to create a new disease, and, of course, for which there'd be no immune response. And as he said, many people say we shouldn't do this because it's another means of mass killing, but we want the $10 million. And 10 years later, of course, he said it'd take us 10 years to produce it. 10 years later, we had the AIDS epidemic. We had chronic fatigue disease. We had fibromyalgia. We had Lyme disease, of course, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And, of course, as far as AIDS, it's very specific for blacks. That's why in the United States, almost half of the new AIDS cases are among the blacks. In fact, of the current number of AIDS people living with AIDS, we have the statistics from the government, 150,000 whites living with AIDS in America, 190,000 blacks, and 80,000 Hispanics. Why does the disease have a predilection for blacks and Hispanics? Because it was planned that way. And, of course, there are 8 different types of AIDS, 8 subdivisions of this terrible, terrible disease. And the one in Africa is much more prone that hit blacks and, of course, to be spread heterosexually than the one they released here in America or the ones they released in Thailand or in Europe or South America. 8 different subdivisions, subtypes of the disease. Nobody's going to tell you that. They're not going to tell you it involves a mycoplasm, which would respond to antibiotics. No, we're going to give them terrible and very expensive medications. There are other treatments, but they, of course, are being concealed. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You really, of course, really need to hear my talk. None dare call it genocide. Planned population reduction. You need to read the material we have. Certainly going into the background of the population control. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Ray Griffith. And Dr. Griffin is a retired theologian, and of course he has spent a great deal of time and effort writing a series of books, and I think about five of them, on what really happened on September 11th of 2001. Now, of course, we saw the planes there, hit the North Tower, one hit the South Tower, and then very shortly after that, the South Tower came down, and then the North Tower came down, and I think... like most people, Dr. Griffin initially accepted, the truth that I'm going to let him tell you. When did you begin to suspect that we had not been told the truth, Dr. Griffin?
It wasn't until I think March of 2003. Up till then, I had just accepted the official story, most other people, and. Not because it's a good story, but just because I was completely ignorant both about what the official story was and then about various facts make the official story impossible. I knew nothing about steel frame high-rise buildings and how they're built, how the World Trade Center buildings in particular were built. I knew nothing about standard operating procedures involving the FAA and the military with regard to intercepting planes that are in trouble or hijacked. I knew nothing about what the really official report was about the Pentagon, and hadn't seen any photos that showed there was no plane there, and so on. So ignorance was a great boost to the official story, and now as people are overcoming their ignorance, fewer and people are believing it.
Well, Chris, what was it that really got your attention, that drew you into this? Certainly something that's consumed you for a number of years now, writing books, and certainly as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Griffin's written some of the best books out there on this subject. Well, certainly, what was it that really finally got you so intrigued that you were really, really willing to look into it and begin to investigate it?
I can't remember which part of the story it was. What I do remember is that it was the when somebody sent me the website that has that had an abbreviated version of Paul Thompson's 9/11 timeline. This website, incidentally, was wanttoknow.info. Which is run there in the Bay Area, and is still one of the best websites for 9/11 and other non-orthodox things. In any case, it just took a few hours of reading through this timeline to see that there were literally dozens, and in fact hundreds, and now thousands of stories that contradict the official story. So that was the first thing that impressed me.
Well, I would love your analogy. You say, well, the government has a conspiracy theory, and government has a conspiracy theory that that 19 Arabs conspired to attack America, and that's a conspiracy theory. But certainly, if they have a conspiracy theory, why should they object to others having a conspiracy theory? And the trouble is that they haven't told us the whole truth. And I think, of course, anybody who criticizes what's going on is, accused of believing in conspiracy. But the government advocates it was a conspiracy. That's how it came about. And that's why nothing was done to stop it. Well, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story? And, of course, there's several views on what happened. One is that, you know, the government knew what was going to happen and didn't try to stop it. And then the other is the fact that in some way somebody, you know, was responsible for those buildings coming down in a way that certainly we witnessed, but is mechanically impossible, and especially Building 7, which came down at about 5:20 that evening. People have even forgotten about that. Two planes hit two buildings, but three buildings came down, three steel-reinforced buildings, which really doesn't make sense. So you pick the story up there.
Yeah, I do remember that early on. The name of the summary that I read was 9/11 allowed to happen, and the stories I focused on at the beginning suggested that you know, that there really were hijackers on the planes. They really did take over the planes and fly them into the buildings, but that the government just had deliberately allowed them to do that. And along the way, though, I kept running into things that couldn't have been just allowed to happen. And the buildings coming down is the preeminent example of that. You can't just stand back and allow two planes to hit two buildings and have those buildings come down at virtually free fall speed, one of them within only less than an hour, the South Tower. We've had buildings with enormous fires in them that burned 12, 15, 18 hours, and not a single floor collapsed, let alone the whole building. Steel frame buildings do not come down because the steel gets really hot. At most, the steel beams start to sag. And you can see photos of that after 15, 18 hours. But they never just come down. So that was clearly something the government couldn't just let happen. It had to be something that people on the inside caused to happen.
And, of course, that is really such a frightening thing. People don't like to think that that sort of thing could happen in America, that anybody would be so callous and indifferent to human suffering that they'd allow people to die. And yet, because they kept telling us immediately after, you know, the buildings came down that 6,000 Americans had died. 6,000 Americans died. And then it was, well, 5,000 Americans died, and then 4,000, and then back to almost a little over 3,000, a little less than 3,000. But of course, there were 2,500 or 2,700 people who worked for Morgan Stanley who were gotten out of the South Tower before it came down. They were told to stay in place. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is David Ray Griffin, who's really done a tremendous amount of study on what happened. And certainly, I know you've talked to many, many people now who are experts on building construction. We're told, of course, that buildings came down, they simply pancaked, one floor collapsed, and then, of course, it was a tremendous pressure from above why the next floor collapsed and the next floor collapsed. And why couldn't that have happened that way?
Yeah, we've had a couple theories about that. One, the original theory was a pancake theory, which was that the floors broke loose from the steel columns. The way the towers were constructed, there were 47 massive core columns, and then you had 240 columns around the outside. And the idea was that when the planes hit the building and created a big hole there, they knocked out a lot of those steel columns, and so the floor right above that big hole fell, and, you know, all the floors above it fell down on the floors below and then broke those loose, and then those fell on the next and broke those, and so it went bang, 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 pancaked all the way down. But there was a big problem. If you remember the old, people are old enough to remember the old 48 what did we call them? The record players with the big black records with the little little hole in the middle, and you had the spindle holding them up. And those would sometimes fall down. You know, when I was a kid, I'd pack, you know, stack about 8 of them up or 10, And once in a while, they'd break loose and they'd all fall down. But, you know, the spindle was still sticking up there in the air. So likewise, with the pancake theory, you should have had 287 columns still sticking up several hundred feet in the air. But, of course, nothing was. Everything came down. So then they had to create a new theory, and the new theory is that something like that happened, but somehow that not only knocked the floor, it didn't knock the floors loose from the steel columns, it caused the steel columns to buckle and even break, so that you had those 287 columns, the ones in the core being massive, just break. And not only did they break, they broke at free fall speed. So all those columns underneath the place where the building started to collapse didn't slow the building down virtually at all, so that the top part of the top floors fell down through the bottom as if the bottom wasn't even there. Well, you've got this little problem called Newton's laws of motion and momentum, and it says there has to be resistance. Now, I mean, the story is just so ridiculous. One fellow has calculated and shown that far from causing all the bottom floors to collapse, even if all those top 15 or 30 floors, depending on what building you're talking about, had collapsed down on the next floor, it just would have stopped everything right then. Nothing would have proceeded, let alone proceeded at as if, you know, it was just air.
Well, I think the amazing thing is that those 47 central very heavy beams that were sticking up there would break, you know, and they would have to, falling at free speed, they would have to break spontaneously, all 47 at each level, all the way down, all spontaneously at every level, or maybe every third level, something like that. There is no other way it could have happened that they could have had that rapid a fall. There would be no resistance. There had been something that destroyed the very structural integrity of that building for it to come down the way it did.
That's right. So one crucial fact is that it came down at virtually free fall speed. You know, it came down in about, each one came down in about 11, 12 seconds. The 9/11 Commission even said the South Tower came down in 10 seconds. Probably a little fast, but close. So that's one factor. How in the world could that happen? Of course, it couldn't. The other one is the complete verticality of the collapse, that instead of toppling over and falling over on other buildings, which would have caused enormous destruction, 110-story buildings, they come essentially straight down after the big explosions at the top. That means that all 287 columns, wherever they failed, as you say, maybe every third floor or so, they had to fail simultaneously. And so even if you could even begin to think about that happening, which you can't rationally, but even if you could, that would mean that the fire, you know, that's the idea, that the fire heated up these columns to the point that they were brittle. They lost 90% of their strength. That's what the 9/11 the official report put out by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, wants you to believe, although they won't quite come out and say it. Let's say that had happened. That would have meant that you would have had to have fires on all those floors, or every third floor, evenly throughout the buildings. Well, you can just look at the videos and see that's not even remotely close to being true. And then you get over to Building 7, which was, you know, only 47 stories. That would be the biggest building, I think, in at least half of the states in the Union. So it's still an enormous building. And you can see from the photos and the videos that it had fires on only three or four floors. And yet all 47 stories, and it had a total of 81 columns. So that would mean those fires on four floors would have had to cause the steel columns on all parts of the building to have heated up equally. Well, you can't get, you know, a symmetrical effect from a completely asymmetrical cause. So for that reason alone, the official story about Building 7, along with that of the towers, would be ludicrous.
Well, I think the thing that finally convinced me, and I really didn't want to accept the truth of this, but I think it was looking at those videos, and they're up on the Internet, anybody can see them. They Google in Building 7 videos, and as you watch the building, the first thing that happens is the center part of the roof caves in. Now, that's what you do with a controlled demolition, so that the building will collapse inward, because if you don't do that, then the building collapses outwards, and then after the center part of the building, it collapses. And that you can see it, that it sort of forms a V there, and the penthouse falls in out of a big void. Then the base of the building collapses, and the building comes down. That has got to be a controlled demolition, and I can't imagine any way that Osama bin Laden could have done that.
No, you know, he did know a little bit about building, but not enough to be able to do the impossible. That is to cause Building 7 to come down by running planes into the two other buildings. The fact that Building 7 is a huge embarrassment to the government is shown by several facts. First of all, the 9/11 Commission did not even mention that Building 7 collapsed. And then, you know, this new book by Philip Sheehan, the New York Times reporter, which is touted as an expose, and it does. It, you know, it reveals some damning truths about the 9/11 Commission, but he stopped far short, and he was the official reporter for the New York Times for the 9/11 Commission, and so he knows all these things, but in his book, he didn't mention a single one of these things that the Commission deleted. Such as this. By the way, I wrote a review on Amazon.com about his book, which is called simply the Commission. So anybody could read that there. Third fact is that the NIST report that I just mentioned did not say anything. It postponed the report on Building 7. It was able to get out its report on the Twin Towers in 2005, only a year late, and they said, well, we couldn't quite get around to Building 7, so we'll do it next year. Well, then in next year, they said, well, we couldn't get it done, we'll do it next year, and then that was 2007, and they said, well, we'll do it next year. And so when August comes of this year, when it's promised, I'm pretty sure we'll find out, well, it won't be available till the Bush administration is out of office. Still another factor is the fact that you never see Building 7 collapse on mainstream television. You see the towers all the time, you know, the buildings getting hit by planes, the big fireballs, and then you sometimes see them come down. You never see Building 7. You've never seen it on mainstream television since that very first night when Dan Rather spoke up and said, hey, that looks just like those buildings that we've all seen brought down by explosives. And finally, then, the really telling thing is a video of a Dutch controlled demolition expert. He's got his own company, and his name is Danny Jowenko, J-O-W-E-N-K-O, if you want to find this on Google, J-O-W-E-N-K-O, Danny. And you'll see that somebody brought in a video of Building 7 coming down and said, could you look at this? We'd just like you to tell us what that is. And he looks at it and he says, well, that's a building being brought down by explosives. That's controlled demolition. He said, you sure? Oh, well, absolutely. You can see this and this and this and this. He said, well, that was brought down on September 11th. And he looks incredulous and says, really? And they say, yeah. He didn't even know, even though that's his field, he had not heard that this third building came down.
And I think
and once he saw it, he said, well, absolutely, there's no doubt about it.
And we'll be back in just a moment with a David A. Griffin right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is David Ray Griffin, and we're talking about what actually happened on September 11th. And, of course, there were a number of things that happened that day that just didn't make sense. Would you like to talk a little bit about that magic, amazing passport that, in fact, there were two of them, weren't there?
Well, there were several alleged passports that were found, and the reason this is important is what 9/11 was, of course, was a false flag operation. That's a term that comes from the old days when ships, battleships, sailing ships, literally, had a flag up, and when they wanted to do a fake attack, they would just put up the flag of another country and attack somebody, and then those people would blame that other country and go start a war with them. And so these have been very common when the Japanese wanted to invade Manchuria in the event that started the Pacific part of World War II. They blew up their own railroad and blamed the Chinese and then proceeded to slaughter several million Chinese in Manchuria. When Hitler wanted to invade Poland, he sent his own troops out across the border dressed in Polish uniforms and had them attack their own outposts. He even left some dead convicts dressed as Poles there to prove that Poland had attacked. And the next day, he invaded Poland and told his people this was a defensive move. But likewise, with 9/11, we were told that Arab Muslims attacked us. So there had to be various kinds of evidence left as proof. So all of these fall apart when you look at them carefully, and that's true of the passports. The funniest ones are the ones that were allegedly found at the World Trade Center. The passport of a guy named Tsukami, who was supposedly on Flight 11 that hit the North Tower, was found. Now, first they said it was found either that evening or the next day. So that means that not only did it escape from the plane and the fiery fireball, the big fireball that was caused when the plane jet fuel exploded, but also it survived the collapse of the building, which really turned virtually everything except the steel into very tiny dust particles. But this passport survived in pretty good shape. That got laughed at in the press, and so they changed the story and said, well, actually they found it shortly after the plane attack that morning, before the building came down. So at that point, all you had to do was believe that the hijackers presumably had these passports in their pockets, and when they flew into the building, and that broke the plane open, and the passport escaped without catching on fire, and floated down to the ground. So. I said that might be the funniest. Actually, I think the funniest is the one at Shanksville. This was supposedly Flight 93 that came down. And at that site...
I'm going to hold you just a moment here as we bring our other stations back on board.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Ray Griffin. We're talking about, of course, the passports. He commented the first passport that was able, of course, it was belonged to one of the hijackers, we're told, was on the plane that morning, and somehow that passport got out of the hijacker's pocket and out of the flaming inferno there in the North Tower, and then drifted down, of course, to the street and was found, at least the second story was found before the North Tower came down. But it was in pristine condition. It was turned over then to the police, and so we know, of course, the hijacker was on the plane because of course, his passport survived. Nothing else survived. I mean, the plane didn't survive. The engines didn't survive. The desks, even the cement blocks. You would have thought there would be a few cement blocks there. The building came down. These big chunks of cement were the floors, but they were all vaporized, but that passport survived. And but then he was talking about the passport that survived at Shanksville. One of the hijackers was supposedly on the plane that crashed at Shanksville. That passport survived as well. So we know, of course, then that the hijacker had to be on the plane. Would you like to tell the story about that passport? Because that's the most incredible story.
Yeah, everybody who showed up at that site, you know, would keep saying, well, where's the plane? There's no plane here. And the official story became, you don't see a plane because the hijackers, when the heroic passengers tried to take over the plane, the hijackers, the pilot turned the plane almost straight down and went down 508 miles an hour and hit that soft Pennsylvania soil, and the plane buried itself completely underground, and then the ground kind of folded over so you couldn't see the plane. So you couldn't even see the tail of the plane, but it was down there. But out on the ground was the passport of the so-called, the alleged pilot, Ziad Jarrar, and also one of the bandanas, the red bandanas that people who supposedly made phone calls from the plane reported that the hijackers were wearing. Big problem, just as a footnote there, these red bandanas are only worn by Shia Muslims, and Al-Qaeda is a Sunni organization, but whoever made up the part about the red bandanas evidently didn't know that. If you recall, President Bush didn't know for a long time the difference between Shia and Sunni. In any case, that was the story, so that the plane was coming down 580 miles an hour, and somehow this passport jumped out of the plane just before it buried itself in the soil.
But, you know, they've never dug up the plane to get the bodies out in the black boxes, you know. Cause
well, they claim they did after everybody left and couldn't see it. So you just have to
take their word for it,
yeah.
I mean, it's the most amazing thing. I've got pictures of that shack that's had a sanctuary, and here's this big hole in the ground. Not even that very big. And certainly there's absolutely no wreckage, no tail, no wings, no nothing. Just a big hole in the ground. It's not even very deep, maybe 20 feet deep, and, you know, maybe, what, 30, 40, maybe 40, 50 feet across, something like that. And but how could you have a crash site without any wreckage? It just doesn't make any sense. And
maybe they just put a big circle of quicksand and it buried. You know, another factor about all these that's something that should set off alarms is that when the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, does report on plane crashes, they always give the serial numbers of the flight data recorder. That's one of the two black boxes. They always do that. And yet, a fellow researcher just told me recently that he wrote in to the NTSB and asked them about that, and well, in the case of the four flights that crashed on 9/11, the report did not have the serial numbers. Now that wasn't the NTSB's fault, probably, because all these crash sites were taken over by the FBI, and so the NTSB was not really allowed to do a report. All they could do was write up what the FBI told them.
And, of course, the amazing thing is, of course, that one passport that survived there at Shanksville had a little burning at the top where you could just see it had been burned. They actually had pictures of it on the FBI website for a week or so, and then they took it down. It's never been seen again. Fortunately, we have pictures of that, at the time. But why would they have taken the picture down, and how did that passport survive? This is truly miraculous. None of the bodies survived that we could find. But the passport survived in almost pristine condition. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, David Ray Griffin, is a theologian retired who's spent a number of, I guess since 2003, researching and writing about certainly what happened. And just a moment when we bring all of our stations back on board, we'll get the names of the books and how you can get hold of them. But certainly, then, of course, we have almost a similar situation. The Pentagon, we would expect there'd be some wreckage out in front when, of course, the tail of the plane or the wings of the plane or something would have broken off when it hit the Pentagon. And how did the plane get down that low? It was a big, great big airplane. What was it, a 757, something like that? And then, of course, but the tail didn't break off. The wings didn't break off. They all sort of went into the building and disappeared.
Yeah, you know, if people aren't aware of the whole 9/11 story and the Truth Movement's response to it, they might think, well, we're just picking up little details. We're cherry-picking little parts of the story that we can ridicule. But the truth is that every part of the official story falls apart. So we're just giving a few illustrations. Like with the alleged hijackers, every part of the evidence collapses. For example, you know, we've been told that people on the planes called their loved ones and reported that they were being hijacked by these men with red bandanas and knives and box cutters and so on. Well, first of all, many of those calls were said to be made on cell phones. So first the 9/11 Truth Movement argued, you can't do that. You can't make cell phone calls. You couldn't in 2001. You can now because they got a new technology. But back then you couldn't do it from an airliner at, 30, 40,000 feet. And the defenders said, oh, yes, you can. But now the FBI has changed the story and said, none of those calls were really made from cell phones. So why did all those people think they were? Why did Dina Burnett say she got four calls from her husband, Tom Burnett, and she knew they were from him because she saw his cell phone number on her caller ID? Now the FBI says he didn't call from a cell phone, he used his air phone. So are we supposed to think Dina Burnett imagined that or that she's lying?
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we bring all of our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Ray Griffin. And first of all, Dr. Griffin's going to be speaking here. He's going to be over in Monterey on the 28th. He's going to be here in Santa Cruz at the church on High Street. I think it's, Episcopalian church up there on High Street. And it's going to be at 7 o'clock on Sunday evening.
No, it's the First Congregational Church.
First Congregational Church.
900 High Street, 7:30. That's Sunday in Santa Cruz.
Right.
In Monterey on Saturday night at 7 o'clock, and that's at the Center for Spiritual Living, which is 400 West Franklin.
All right, fine. Thank you very much. Could you give those just one more time for our listeners?
Okay, Saturday night, June 28th, 7 o'clock, Center for Spiritual Living, 400 West Franklin. And then Sunday night, June 29th, 7:30, First Congregational Church at 900 High Street. I know it's in Monterey. They say if you want to come early and get your book signed, come at 6:30. If not before.
All right, fine. And Chris, you've written a number of books. And are they listed? Do you have a website where people can go?
I don't, but I just, I use Amazon.com as my website. They've got all my books. The most recent books and the ones most relevant for these lectures, the lecture at in Santa Cruz will be on, I've got a book called Debunking 9/11, Debunking, An Answer to Popular Mechanics and Other Defenders of the Official Theory. There I will just respond to popular mechanics and not all the other defenders. And then in on the former night, on Saturday night in Monterey, I'll be focusing on my newest book, which is called 9/11 Contradictions, an Open Letter to Congress and the Press. And I'll be, in that book, I give 25 internal contradictions within the official story. So in that book, there's nothing about the towers or the Pentagon, you know, why it's physically impossible. The book just details 15 internal contradictions within the official story, such as, you know, where was General Myers that morning? He was the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so he was the highest officer in the Pentagon. So it's pretty important where he was, and yet Richard Clark, in his book, Against All Enemies, says, well, he was in the Pentagon, and he was on my video. So Clark says, I brought up the screen, there's Richard Myers along with Donald Rumsfeld, and yet Myers himself in the 9/11 Commission said, oh no, he wasn't there, he was up on Capitol Hill. Talking about getting ready for his confirmation hearing. Well, that's pretty stunning that you would have a disagreement as to where General Richard Myers was. Well, likewise, I just published a piece today, you can Google, called Tim Russert, Dick Cheney, and 9/11. And I talk about the interview that Dick Cheney did with Tim Russert on Meet the Press just 5 days after 9/11. In fact, Dick Cheney recently referred to that meeting, and that interview. And in that interview, you find that Cheney told a story about his behavior that morning as to when he went down to the underground bunker that contradicted what the 9/11 Commission would say in 2004. So that's pretty stunning that you've got that kind of contradiction as to where Cheney, who was clearly in charge in the White House that morning, where he was. So I'll talk about that contradiction and maybe a dozen more.
Well, of course, the thing is that if the government is lying about anything, then I think we should be suspicious that they're lying about everything. And, of course, you know, one of the most amazing things about this story is certainly the 1,100 bodies from the Twin Towers have never been found. 1,100 of those bodies. Well, you would think, of course, that the buildings had pancaked. Why, they would have been squashed and certainly would have been compressed and would have killed them. But, you know, it's certainly the bodies, little fragments of other bodies, some of the bodies have been found on adjacent buildings, but how would they get over to adjacent buildings if the building had just simply pancaked? My understanding is that even some of the major beams had actually been thrown out 400 or 500 feet.
Well, that's right, and it's not just your understanding. One can actually see that if you look at Loose Change Final Cut, for example, for which I happen to be the script consultant, and it's completely different. Every frame is different from the earlier Loose Changes. There was one and two. This is the third one. And you see in there these sections of three or four of these columns, massive things weighing, you know, thousands of tons, that were blown out 500 feet and plastered on a neighboring building. So then when you realize that there was something else, there was something going on there that gave horizontal force, whereas according to the official story, the only force acting would have been, at that moment, would have been gravity, which pulls things straight down. Well, then when you realize that, then you realize, well, it's not so surprising that some parts of the bodies, very tiny bone fragments, were also found on buildings several hundred feet away. So that gives you a clue as to why so many of these bodies were never found. They were completely, it's gruesome to think about, but they were blown to smithereens by these powerful explosives that were going off. And, you know, when you think about it, you've got to slice 287 columns in each of the towers, and you've got to slice them simultaneously on each of the floors, and probably every third or fourth floor, the steel columns came down evidently in pieces 20 to 35 feet long. So that's an enormous amount of explosive material, an enormous number of explosives, very powerful explosives going off to slice steel. Well, of course, it's going to blow up bodies, human bodies, as well.
Well, I think the thing is, of course, that you'd expect, you know, if it's a pancake, and you have this at these cement floors at each level, of course, they're in some sort of a metal container, but they're cement floors, and so you would have had a lot of big chunks of concrete there, but you didn't have a lot of chunks of concrete. It seems like it was all sort of vaporized.
That's right. If you took a big piece of concrete up to top of a 110-story building and dropped it off, it would break into fairly small pieces, but these would be pieces you could pick up and maybe put in your pocket, or it might even be bigger than that. They would not be demolished into very tiny dust particles that would get into people's lungs. And yet that's what happened that morning. Almost, and you know, these aren't just 9/11 truth members. These are people from the Army Corps of Engineers and saying there was nothing but steel and dust. No tables, no computers, no desks, no nothing except tiny dust particles. And so we've got massive evidence from various directions showing that very powerful explosives were going off in the building. And so I say this is the most convincing evidence that the government didn't just let something happen on that day. They planned and they executed, and of course literally executed, several thousand people.
Well, one of the interesting things, and I just learned this, I'm sure you're well aware of it, but apparently the man in charge of the fire department there had actually had a lot of the firemen actually sit down and record what had happened, what they witnessed that day, so that they would not forget it, so they would be fresh in their minds. And then somebody sealed that information so that nobody could hear it. What's that story all about?
Well, yeah, and here is a place where, although the New York Times has been pretty good at covering up the problems in the official story, in some cases they've done some things that have exposed the truth. And in this case, they fought the city of New York, Mayor Bloomberg's city hall, to get these oral testimonies released. And it took them several years, but they finally were released in a few years ago, and they were amazing. I wrote a story, again, people can Google this, just called Explosive Testimony, and this turned out to be quite a popular summary of a lot of these oral testimonies, both by firefighters and emergency medical workers who were also part of the fire department of New York. So anyway, the New York Times plus some of the families of the victims went to court, and they kept losing until they went to the highest court in New York, and they finally forced the city to release them. And the New York Times, to their credit, put them on their own website, so you can go on and read these for yourselves and make sure we're not just making this up. And one fellow then, after my brief study, did a complete study, read all 503 of these, and reported that as far as people giving rather graphic descriptions, realistic descriptions that suggested explosives were going off, there were 118 of these. Now, these were all people who were volunteering this information. They weren't asked, well, did you hear explosions going off? They just, in the course of telling what happened that day, reported this. So that means one-fourth of the people who gave these oral testimonies reported phenomena suggestive of explosions. And yet when NIST gave its report, when the 9/11 Commission gave its report, they didn't mention a one of these, even though they both, as you, if you read their notes in the back of their report, both had read them all. So they knew what we knew, and yet they just kept silent about it. And finally, when a group called NIST on this and said, well, what about all these testimonies, and quoted them, some of them, NIST just said, well, we thought the preponderance of evidence didn't suggest explosives were going off. And I guess that by that they meant that you didn't have 51% of the people testifying that explosives had gone off.
Well, you know, Chris, I think the most significant thing is that they actively suppressed it. If they weren't trying to suppress this information, then why did they suppress it? If they weren't trying to conceal it, why did they conceal it for years? And, fight this all the way up to the state Supreme Court. So obviously, there is a conscious effort on part of somebody to cover up the truth about what happened that day.
Yeah, quite a few somebody. So here we have the city of New York, then we have the 9/11 Commission. And now we have the NIST report. Now, people might think these are neutral bodies, but the main thing that Sheenan's book reveals about the 9/11 Commission, more facts than we even knew, is that the commission was clearly run not by the commissioners you saw on TV, but by Philip Zelikow, and that he was... virtually a member of the Bush administration. He had even written the document that used 9/11 to justify going to war in Iraq, a new doctrine of preemptive warfare. And yet here's the guy who's supposed to be in charge of a neutral, nonpartisan commission that would be asking, among other things, was 9/11 at all the fault of the Bush White House? With regard to NIST, you know, that sounds nice. National Institute of Standards and Technology. Nice, neutral, scientific organization. Not at all. It's an agency of the Commerce Department and therefore of the Bush-Cheney administration now. And a recent whistleblower has reported, he had worked for NIST, that it's completely politicized, and that they couldn't publish anything without it being approved by the Commerce Department and also by a watchdog from the White House itself. And so he said the scientists there are little more than hired guns anymore, and that many of them know that they put out a phony report, but, they don't dare speak up or, of course, they lose their jobs.
And, of course, not only they'll lose their jobs, they may have difficulty getting another one. So
that's right.
This has happened to other people, like William Rodriguez, the last man out of the North Tower. He was the one of the chief janitors there. And of course, they blackballed him. He couldn't get a job anywhere. I don't know if he's ever gotten a job. Perhaps he has. But, of course, his story was that he actually heard explosives in the basement of the building. He was in the second sub-basement, but even down below that in the building, the North Tower, before the plane hit above. So, and he testified before the 9/11 Commission. But they sealed his testimony and the testimony of 1,100 other people who testified before the 9/11 Commission report. And they sealed those reports for 50 years. Why would they have done that?
Well, they probably learned from the Warren Report, which put out all of its testimony, and so people were able to compare what the Warren Report said with what the people who testified to the Warren Commission actually said. And there was one woman who did an amazing research job, took her several years, and she showed in graphic detail the absolute contradictions between what people had testified to and what the Warren Commission sometimes said these people said. And so they learned from that. Keep this testimony sealed for a very long time until everybody is safely dead.
Well, because we're talking about the murder of almost 3,000 Americans. But even worse than that, and more terrifying, is the fact that this then led us into a war with Afghanistan. A war with Afghanistan, you're not hearing about it, but it's going very, very poorly, and an awful lot of Americans have died, an awful lot of Afghans have died.
If you go on the website and ask, how many, or go on Google and say, how many people have been killed in Afghanistan because of the American invasion, you will find a rather stunning figure, something like 6 million Afghans.
Well, of course, men and women have become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And I think each one of us has to find out where in the truth, and then what are we going to do about it? Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Griffin. All right, fine. Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. What message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
I've got a DVD. I don't make money from these DVDs, so I'm not trying to push this to make money, but to make a point, that's called 9/11, Let's Get Empirical. And that's all you really need to do to see that the official story is false. I begin the book, Debunking 9/11, Debunking, with the statement that the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job is overwhelming. The only problem is to get people to look at the evidence with even a 10 or 20 or 30% open mind. That's very difficult to do because people come at it with all these ideas they think they already know to be true, and then all these why would they do this kind of question. And one of these is, our government is moral. Why would it do such a thing? Or this or that, or how could they have done this? How could have they gotten explosives planted in the buildings? And my response is, there are actually pretty good answers to these questions, but, another big one is, well, somebody would have talked by now. And there's a good answer to that one, too. But the first thing you need to do is just look at the evidence. Rather than saying they couldn't have done it, this can't be true, look at the evidence, and then you quickly see, oh, it has to be true. There's nothing else that could explain this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And then you start to see that all the evidence for the official story falls apart under examination. So that would be my message. Let's get empirical. And I've written my 6 books about this in order to help people get empirical about it and see the facts. And once they see the facts, the official story is all over.
Where can people get your DVD? Is that available through your website? Or they
They're becoming available also on Amazon, or you can email KenJenkins@AOL.com. He also has a website for these, but I keep forgetting it. And but you can get them from Amazon or directly from him.
Is that Ken?
K-E-N as in Kenneth. Yeah,
right,
Ken Jenkins, J-E-N-K-I-N-S, at AOL.com.
All right, fine. Well,
and I believe they will all be for sale at the lectures, also in Monterey and Santa Cruz.
All right, well, just hold on for just a moment. We want to bring all of our stations back on board, and then I want you, of course, to tell us just one more time where you're going to be speaking that recently. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just one more time, Dr. Griffin, you'll be speaking on the 28th, which is Saturday, in Monterey, the 29th of June, here in Santa Cruz, at the First Congregational Church on High Street. Once again, the address is where you're going to be speaking.
Okay, in Monterey, 7 o'clock, that's the Center for Spiritual Living, 400 West Franklin, and Sunday night, the 29th, at the First Congregational Church, 900 High Street, 7:30 in the evening.
Thank you very much. God bless, and I really appreciate you being with us. I hope you get a great turnout. Thanks so much.
Okay, Stan. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now, of course, our guest this evening has been Dr. David Ray Griffin, a retired theologian who has taken unto himself to try to get the truth, and he's written 6 books on this. We're going to see about getting that DVD and see if we can carry that here through Radio Liberty. If you'd like to get some of the material we have, where did this whole radical Islamic movement come from? Well, of course, we have a book called The Devil's Game. You need to get it. You need to read it. You need to read our 3 pamphlet set, $4.911. Everything is being done to get the American Christians to hate the Muslims. We get TV factors almost every day telling us about the Islamofascists, how they hate us, they want to kill us. But they're doing the same thing over in the Muslim countries. They're trying to get the Muslims to hate us. That's how you get a war going, and this is really what it's all about, in my estimation. They want to get a war going between the United States and the Muslim world. Trouble is, there's 1.25 billion Muslims, and if we get into a war with them, they're going to end up having nuclear weapons as well, because we've already given those weapons to the Pakistanis. Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, they're not telling you, but that's Sybil Edmonds' story, and you can read it up on my internet. I believe it's in January newsletter for this year. So the story of Sybil Edmonds, we actually had given the Pakistanis the wherewithal through a spy ring operating in our government, which had the full cooperation of our State Department, to transfer to Pakistan the information by which they'd be able to build their nuclear weapons and the material to build them with. Why would you do that? Because you want a nuclear war. And you say, why would anybody do anything like that? Well, why were American corporations building the military equipment for Adolf Hitler prior to the Second World War? And why are we doing everything we can to build the military capacity of communist China today? And why are we doing everything we can to build up the military capacity of communist Russia today? If you haven't read our pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, you need to get it. It's a little pamphlet. It's very important. But understand, we're heading towards a war with the Muslim world, and it all started on 9-1-1. That's why we need to get the truth there. And if you don't want your sons and daughters being drafted or being incinerated in this country in a nuclear war, you get involved and help us get the truth out. You need, of course, to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. Understand how they're using the oil problems, the oil crisis, to destroy our economy. And, of course, what do you do when you have that? Why, of course, you go to war. They know exactly what they're doing. The book we suggest, of course, is The Devil's Game, the pamphlets, Foreknowledge 911, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We have DVDs on, of course, what happened on September 11th. We have, of course, The In Plain Sight, 911 Mysteries. That's 911 Mystery. We have a new one called Blueprint for Terror, put out by Richard Gage from the Architects and Engineers for 911 Truth. And it's excellent, I might add. It's a brand new one. We're just starting to carry it. Blueprint for Tyranny, and of course by Richard Gage, and then 911 Mysteries. In Plain Sight, you can go, ask our staff there. We have actually 5 or 6 DVDs we carry. The Ripple Effect is another one. And then, of course, you need to understand, of course, what happened on 911 is not what you think happened. You need then to get involved. You need to help us reach others. You need to get them listening to Radio Liberty. And then you need to try to get people elected who represent American values, not the international values of those dedicated to the New World Order, the New World Religion. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Good night.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.